Hey podcaster, welcome to the Lockdown Show podcast with me, SCG. You're most likely listening to this on iTunes or Spotify, and thank you so much for checking this show out. And if you like this content, head over to YouTube and subscribe to my channel, The SCG Show, and look for the playlist, The Lockdown Show Podcast, to hear more. Okay, let's begin with today's special episode. My guest today is a jazz pianist. He's also been described as the two-hand pianist as well, Mike Jones. And he's even worked with the magicians Penn and Teller. He's got an amazing discography. We're going to talk everything about music, jazz music, and even what it's like working personally with the likes of Penn and Teller, actually making albums with them as well. I'm a huge music fan. I'm a musician myself. Always wanted to be good enough to play the piano, and Mike can play the piano with his eyes closed. Maybe he might play us a little something for the interview as well towards the end. Who knows? Anything can happen. Anyway, let's begin with the podcast.
Mike Jones, thank you very much for jumping onto my podcast.
A pleasure.
Thank you. I ask everybody this question, well, mostly everybody. Where are you from and where are you based, and how has the coronavirus pandemic affected your life?
Okay, well, I live in Las Vegas, Nevada. And as you can imagine, an entire city built on tourists, it is very slow. Everything's shut down. There was an overall sense of fear, and I believe the highest unemployment rate in the United States, because everyone works for the entertainment industry or the casino hotel industry. So I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but something like 30 or 40% of the population here was suddenly woke up without a job.
I heard things are getting back to normal where you are.
Well, things are moving in the direction of getting back to normal. Just yesterday, they finally got the go-ahead to open some hotels and casinos, and they're opening them in, not in phases, but not everyone opened. So Caesars Entertainment that owns Caesars Palace and the Flamingo, basically the two huge companies in Las Vegas, corporations, are Caesars and MGM. And MGM owns half the strip and Caesars owns half the strip. And then there's a few independent hotels like Treasure Island. And but Caesars opened, originally said that they would open Caesars Palace and the Flamingo yesterday. And then it came out 3 days ago that they were also going to open Harrah's because of demand. So MGM is open, the MGM, New York, and I believe they're opening Aria and the Bellagio. So I'm hopeful that the demand is so much that by the end of June, everyone's open again, you know. But having said that, in my business, they still don't know how to deal with shows. Because there still is this, everyone's frightened of how are they going to put 1,500 people in a room to watch a show, or put 500 people in a nightclub to sweat all over each other. So there's a lot of everything's unknown and there's a lot of uncertainty and still a lot of fear. But having said that, it seems like a lot of people still want to come to Las Vegas and so there's some excitement about that too. So I think we'll just see how it plays out in the next 2 or 3 weeks. I'm secretly hopeful that we'll be back sometime in July, because this is the longest in my adult life that I've gone without working and I don't like it.
No, I don't blame you, especially for the line of work you do. I've given you an introduction to this video anyway, but I want people to hear it from the horse's mouth. So tell us right back where you started, even at college, to where you are now, the kind of career that you've had.
Before college, I You know, I started playing when I was about three. So when I was either 14 or 15, 1976, I had my first professional job. My piano teacher had too many gigs for New Year's Eve and hired me to play a New Year's Eve gig in 1976. And then in 77, I started playing at a local restaurant in Buffalo called Danny Sansone's. And I was just playing in the bar area. And then I went off to Berklee College of Music. And I'm trying to think. When I got out of there, I started working at a recording studio in Boston called Soundtrack Recording Studio. And they had studios in Boston and New York, and they did all the jingle work in Boston and a lot of work in New York. And now it's the last big independent studios left in Boston and New York. They do a lot of television and movie production now. They do all of Ron Howard's films and Martin Scorsese's films. And but back then, I was doing jingles and playing on TV and radio commercials, and then playing a gig at the Ritz-Carlton. And then I got a call to play. We got a call to write the theme music and soundtrack for a new TV show called The Nancy Merrill Show. And they wanted me to be an on-air personality and play the piano every morning. Sort of like Paul Schaefer did on David Letterman.
Yeah, sure.
And so I started doing that, and I was at the Ritz every night. And my first year out of college, I thought, wow, this is the greatest. This is great. This is, you know, I'm on TV every day and I'm playing every night. This is easy. I guess being a musician isn't that hard. and then the next year, the gig went off the air, the TV show went off the air, and I still worked at the Ritz. And then I worked around Boston and doing studio work in Boston and New York for many years. And I'm trying to remember, in 1999, I was working with a singer, and she contacted an old agent that she had in Las Vegas. And I have to say that from 1986 to 1999, the studio scene that I was a part of was falling apart. The jingle houses, the big ad agencies, Hill Holiday and all the big jingle houses, they stopped hiring real musicians for their television and radio commercials and started having an in-house person do it on Pro Tools or on, a keyboard. And so from the ad agencies, you know, why would they hire a huge band and pay $30,000-$40,000 for an hour's worth of musicians when they can have a kid that they're paying minimum wage sit in a room at their office and do it. So when I first went to New York, I was doing, 40, 50 commercials a month, 40 or 50 studio sessions a month. And by the time I left in 1999, I was doing three. And, cause the business was just going away. That business model was obsolete. It was like making 8-track tapes, you know?
Can I interrupt you there for one second? Because I didn't know this about you. So you were a jingle man. That's awesome. So any jingles that we would have heard of, because I know you got your piano there. Is there anything?
I played on them. I didn't write them. But I mean, there were a lot of we did stuff for Ford and McDonald's we just dozens, hundreds over the years. But it was, it was good money, and I was spending half my time in Manhattan and half my time in Boston. And I started working with a singer that had done some jingle work and worked at the studio. And she was, about 10 or 15 years older than I was. And she said, we should go out to Vegas. She called her old agent that was out here who had retired. And, he hooked us up with his partner, and we came out here supposedly for an insane amount of money, $5,000 a week and an apartment. So I thought, well, why not? There's not a lot of work left in New York and Boston for doing what I did, which was, at the same time that this was happening around the turn of the century, all of the rooms that I used to play in Boston, every hotel had a lounge with live music in it. And over the years, they just started cutting it down and cutting it down. And as a matter of fact, about 3 or 4 years ago, someone sent me an article from the Boston Globe saying that the last place in Boston that had live piano music has stopped it, which was the Copley Plaza. Now, when I was there, I could name you 18 places off the top of my head that had a piano player from 5 to 9 and 9 to 1, 7 nights a week. So all the teachers at Berklee and all the teachers at New England Conservatory and Boston Conservatory would all supplement their income playing these gigs, and they none of them exist anymore. So I came to, anyways, to make a long story even longer, came out to Las Vegas, shipped up my apartment in New York and Boston, and moved out here, got halfway out here, only to find out that the agent had lied to us and he hadn't signed the contract and there was no gig. So damn. We got out here, and the agent, who shall remain nameless.
That's very, very nice of you.
Yes. He's probably close to death now, so he'll get what he deserves. But he took one look at the singer, who was in her mid-50s or late 50s. I don't remember at the time. He took one look at the singer and said, I can't book you in this town looking like this. You'd have to get a facelift and lose 30 pounds. And I mean, she was a great singer, but you know, it's Vegas. So if you're not 25 and gorgeous, they don't want to book you, you know? Sure. And I had never, ever in my life, I mean, at that time I had been playing professionally since 1976 and it's 1999, right? Mm-hmm. So I had never been, my whole life was, if you get really good, you get gigs. And that's the way it is on the whole East Coast of the United States, Boston, New York. You know, if you're a good player, you can work. And here's this woman who's singing better than Rosemary Clooney, who knows all the standards, who's a really great singer. And she comes into this place and they tell her she can't work because she doesn't look good enough. And I mean, we played all kinds of places in New York together. That's never an issue, you know. So it was a rude awakening for me, you know. And anyway, she went back to New York and I stayed here. I got a gig subbing for a guy at the Bellagio, and the entertainment director came up to me. I was there for a week, and he came up to me and he said, "Wow, everybody's talking about you. You're the best piano player I've ever heard. I'd never hire you." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, yeah, I want people to walk in and say, 'Oh, look, a piano player. Oh, Wheel of Fortune machine.'" He said, "That's how much attention I want paid to the musicians in this town." So I was like flabbergasted. I couldn't believe it, you know, and I didn't know what to do. So anyways, to make a long story even longer, I took this gig, the worst gig in my life. I took the worst gig in my life at a restaurant, which shall remain nameless for copyright issues. But it's a, let's just say it's a restaurant in Las Vegas at a casino named after a city. And there's this really big tower in the city, and the tower in the city where a lot of them speak French. they have this restaurant here at the recreation of that famous tower in that famous city in France.
The Venetian, right?
Pardon?
Yeah. The Venetian.
And I took a job playing the piano there, and it was, by many respects, the most insulting thing I'd ever done. I did it because I needed money. I mean, I hadn't worked in almost a year, and my savings were gone, you know. So I take this gig, and it's a nightmare. And at the same time that happened, one of my friends named Neil Tesser, who wrote the Playboy Guide to Jazz, he was the jazz editor for Playboy magazine. He had a great radio show in Chicago. And anyways, he calls me up one day out of the blue and he says, "I'm doing the liner notes for an Oscar Peterson record." Now, Oscar Peterson, for those listeners that don't know, is probably the most famous jazz pianist in history. And so they were reissuing on a thing called the Verve Master Edition. They were reissuing some Oscar Peterson records from the 1950s. and they would come out in this deluxe packaging. And so they hired Neil to write about Oscar. So he called me up because he knew I had studied with Oscar and I knew Oscar. And he said, what can I write about Oscar that hasn't already been written a million times? So I went on an hour and a half talk about, you know, you've got to write about his arranging, and the arranging for the trio was, it's like no one ever did that kind of stuff. Key changes every two measures and all this kind of stuff. So I talked to him and talked to him and talked to him. And then about 3 months later, the CD came out and the liner notes were all about me, which was great and very sweet. So I get a call one day from a guy named Michael Close. And Mike Close is probably, with Wright Close and Ricky Jay, are probably the two greatest close-up magicians in history. Mike wrote the textbook that every young magician works out of, called the Workers series. And he's hugely respected. And he was a good friend of Penn and Teller's. And he provided a lot of work on their show as a consultant. So he's also a great jazz pianist. So all of a sudden, one day, I get a phone call from a guy named Mike Close, who I've never heard of. And he said, I just read these Oscar Peterson liner notes, and it says you live in Las Vegas. I want to come and hear you play. And I said, well, I'm working the worst gig of my life. If you want to come and pay $150 for dinner at a, you know, average restaurant, that's where I'll be. And he said, well, I'm coming tonight. And I said, okay. So anyways, he showed up with Penn Jillette, his buddy. And unbeknownst to me at the time, Penn had started playing acoustic bass. He had played electric bass his whole career, and he had fallen in love with, he did a bit with the Smothers Brothers, and he'd fallen in love playing an acoustic bass. So he bought one and he was taking lessons. So he was very nice. And I went over and talked to him on a break, and I said, you know, in a month, I'm recording a new album here. They're bringing up, I have an endorsement deal with Kauai Pianos, and they're bringing up this $200,000 piano from California, and the record company's coming out from New York, and we're going to record a live album here in Vegas. If you want to come, you know, feel free to drop by. And I was just being polite. I never in a million years dreamed he would show up. And he showed up with Mike Close and about seven other people. And we started hanging out. And then about a week later, he sent me an email. This was sort of before texting became a thing. This is in 2001. He said, I'd like to hang out with you. And I thought to myself, well, I can't hang out with this rich guy. You know, I'm a bum piano player. Mm-hmm. And he said, let's go to lunch next week. And so I met him for lunch, and we went and saw a variety show that he knew people in. And he turned out that his mom had passed away recently, and my mom had passed away a month before. And we both loved our moms tremendously. And we just sort of bonded. And I started hanging out with him. And he turned out to be a great guy and not an egotistical asshole like many stars. His personality was, you know, kind of a bully on their TV show and their, you know, but he was really a sweet, good guy. So he said, I want to get better at jazz. And I'd like to have you, you know, you and a couple other musicians come over every Tuesday night, and we'll have jazz night at my house, because he had a stage in his house. And so we did that and started that. And then about the end of 2001, he called me. They were on the road, and he called me up and he said, we're going to be at the Rio full time. And instead of adding an extra showgirl or two, we think we'd like you to play in our show. And I said, what do you need a jazz piano player for in a magic show? Because I'm great at getting myself work, you know. He said, well, I want to play with you every night. And I said, you've been playing upright bass for a year, Penn. You're going to get up in front of 1,500 people a night? He said, well, I'm not going to get any better if I don't practice. And I said, okay. So I played the first night with him. And 19 years later, I'm still with him.
Now, are you talking about... there's a very famous trick that they do, the sleight of hand, the smoking sleight of hand. And I remember Penn actually playing the bass, the acoustic bass, to like that. It's a unique song. Is that something that you've written? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, somebody wrote that for them back when they were on Broadway in the late 80s.
Oh, but, sorry.
But it's like, no, but it's like.
Yeah.
That's called Shadows. Not Shadows. I'm blanking on the name of the trick. Because we, you know, since
Sleight
I've
of
been
Hand?
Them,
it's not called the Sleight of Hand.
No, it's called Misdirection.
That's it. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, since I've been with them, I've written almost 30 pieces of music for them. That's how much they changed the show. You know, I mean, they're constantly writing new material. And so I did the opening hour with Penn. And then the next week they said to me, do you want to play the fire eating music? And I said, sure. And then the next week they came to me and said, we're putting a new bit in the show. Do you want to write some music for it? And I said, sure. And then it grew from there. So, I mean, basically, and then when we went to Broadway 5 years ago, they said, we'd like you to write the entire show, like play for every trick and almost every trick and write music to connect all the tricks together, you know? And so I did that. And since then, you know, I'm basically on stage the 2.5 hours a night.
Wow.
So that's the entire story of how I met Penn. So I basically owe it all to this guy named Neil Tesser.
Wow. So what's this? I mean, obviously, forget the pandemic, but in normal times, what's the situation? They've got their show Fool Us, which is on television. But what else? Have they got a residency in Vegas as well?
Oh, yeah. We've been at the Rio for 19 years, wow. 5 nights a week,
wow.
250 nights a year.
Wow.
And and I mean, it's, you know, it's perennially sold out. I mean, it's 1500 seats, and, you know, it may slow down a little bit like this time of year normally because it starts to get really hot in Vegas. But I mean, it's, you know, the average, I think I want to say something like maybe 220,000 seats a year they sell or something.
Wow.
You know, wow. I think that's, I don't remember, but a lot. and you know, and it's really, and also Penn and Teller, they first came to Vegas in 94 and they would do like little runs at Bally's and the MGM, but they both bought houses out here and became sort of a part of the community. So they do stuff for local Vegas charities, and they're really well known and established in Vegas, you know.
So they're fully engrossed in the culture. They're fully engrossed in the city. Yeah.
It's really nice. So pre-pandemic, everything was great.
know? Pretty. So would you call yourself a professional musician? Is that the, like, if people ask, what do you do?
Yeah. I mean, I've never had a real job. I mean, I've 57 years old. I've made a living playing music my entire life. I've got, you know, 14 CDs out, 12, 14 CDs. I've always had a record label. I mean, I've never like done independent records for myself. You know what I mean? I'm on Capri Records right now. Before that, I was on a record label called Chiaroscuro. You know, independent jazz labels.
Do you think you've been doing what you've been doing for so long, in particular working with two of the most famous magicians of all time? Let's say, I mean, let's be honest, probably two of the most famous, you know, names, faces.
Yeah.
Do you ever just think to yourself, like, do you ever just look across the stage or wherever you're positioned, or do you ever look and think, Jesus, like, how did this happen? Like, how am I suddenly doing this for so long? Are you just accustomed to it now?
Well, no. I mean, certainly when I was first with them, you know, Mike Close actually said to me one time, you know, he said, you know, you're in the greatest magic show in history, right? Mm. And that really struck home. But when I first was with them, it was a whole nother level of, it was something I had never trained for, because being a jazz pianist and always working for myself and under my own name, it was, there's a pressure to put on a good show, but I know what I can do. And if I make screw something up, I can cover it. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, the first few nights I was playing like in their show and part of their show, if anything goes wrong, it's my fault. You know what I mean? If I screw up a music cue, I've wrecked a show from these Emmy winners that are on Broadway right now. You know what I mean? So that was like a totally different level of pressure and fright, you know? But I mean, I don't want to, I'm never blasé about it. And I'm always aware that, you know, I'm not only like playing with friends of mine, it's a really important show, you know? And I've never been embarrassed. I mean, I know people that work for people that are sort of show busy type stars here in Vegas that, you know, there's a level of embarrassment, you know, they're happy for the gig, but they're like sort of apologetic when they say, ah, you know, I'm working for this guy. It's, you know, it's a living, you know what I mean? I've never felt it, any of that with these guys because it's like working with Houdini or something. You know what I mean?
Immensely professional, aren't they? They are just on another.
There's no comparison. I mean, and as I said, I've been around show business for 35 years. And I've met a lot of famous people. And, you know, I don't want to
any name all... drops? Any name drops, anyone?
You know, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, in passing, I've met, like, people like Steve Martin and Eric Idle. And, you know, and when you get to that level, they're all cool. Because they're all really, really comfortable with who they are. You know what I mean? They're successful. They're not desperate. It's the second tier of showbiz wannabe hopefuls that are like not good to be around. But I mean, like Penn and Teller are very secure in what they do and they're wonderful guys as well. I mean, as people too. I don't mean just as performers. And I mean, they're genius performers. I mean, forget it. They've written, you know, 100 hours worth of unique material. Who else in history of magic has done that, you know? But the thing is, they're also like genuine friends. Yeah, they would have to be after 20 years that they would have kicked me out of their show. You know what I mean?
that's what I wanted to ask you. You're buddies with them, yeah? You meet up, you socialize with each other and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, less so more recently. Well, of course, first through the pandemic, you know, not at all. But I mean, you know, Teller is a good friend. We don't socialize as much as I do with Penn, but Penn and I used to be together all the time, you know, for years. But as he's gotten married and had kids, he just has other priorities, you know. He doesn't have time to just hang around Starbucks for 3 hours. And, you know, but I still, you know, obviously we see him every day, you know, and do the show every night. But they're good guys. And it's a really great, great thing to be a part of. Because no matter what, it's a different level. I mean, you can be the greatest jazz pianist in history, which I'm not, but Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, Keith Jarrett, they're all at that level of fame and fortune that Penn and Teller are. You know what I mean? But I mean, they're not a lot more. Monty Alexander, you know what I mean? But to be in the level of show business where you decide you're going to do a Broadway run and every show is sold out before you set foot on stage. That's like the real A-list, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I would have never been exposed to the people that I've been exposed to in the last 20 years without them. You know what I mean? I wouldn't be sitting backstage talking to Stephen Sondheim or George Lucas or any of those people without having met Penn and Teller, you know?
Yeah, sure, you know? Sure.
And yeah, it's just a different level. And it's really cool to be a part of.
Is it different, Mike? So like, for example, you've got a set routine. Obviously the show changes all the time, but like, is it the same show, but different? Like, is it just routine? Like, what is it like performing the same show, like every day, 5 days a week? Like, does it feel different?
Well, it feels different every night because, you know, it all depends on the crowd and how Penn's interacting with the crowd. But yes, the show, I mean, and the pre-show, we play different songs every night. You know what I mean? Because I'm calling the songs and Penn just is playing along. So, you know, so there's a variety there. But obviously all the music that's contained in the show has to be note perfect because there are many cues from lighting cues to sound cues to movement cues of tricks. all of that has to be locked in. And that's when I say they change the show, they do change the show a lot. There's always, I mean, just for example, the last 5 or 6 years, we have to put 13 new tricks in the show every year because they have to have a new closing trick for Fool Us every show. And there's 13 shows in the season.
So,
but every time they do put a new show in, the crew has to come in. They have to learn the moves of when to bring the props in and out. Lighting has to do a scene. Teller has to direct it and decide what he wants it to look like. I have to write music for it. You know what I mean? So it's a production all the time. I mean, every Tuesday afternoon, there's rehearsal. And they've been together for 40 years, you know? But they're still writing new stuff and doing new things. And it's one of the great things about them is that they never coast, ever, you know? And I mean, it would be easy for Penn. I mean, you do fall into, like, when I'm playing bits that we've been playing for a while, you know, I find that I go on automatic pilot because I, you know, I know it has to be just right, but I learn it and it's just right, you know. And the only time I ever find myself having a trouble, like, and this is the last time, was 17 years ago, was thinking about what I was playing while I was playing it, you know. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, where am I in this? You know, instead of letting it just go over you. But you know, yeah, it's never routine. There's different, you know, as Robbie Liven, our stage manager, Bert's our stage manager, but Robbie will say never the same show once, you know, because you know, you can't control the audience interaction. You don't know what someone's going to do when they come up on stage. And, you know, I mean, Penn is a genius at handling people, and Teller is as well. I mean, they've been doing it their whole career, but you know, you get people up there and they freak out or they're scared or, you know, so it's, you know, it's live show business. And I, you know, it's the way it is, but it's wonderful.
I got to ask you, any secrets, magic secrets you could share with us at all? Is there anything?
I don't know anything. I mean, I'm lucky to know. I'm lucky to know the songs that I'm playing, you know. People always ask me that. They're like, oh, you've been with them almost 20 years. You must know how everything's done. And I always say the same thing. If I did, I wouldn't tell you. You know?
We've got to go to music now. We've got to talk about pianos. We've got to talk about music. But I've got to ask you very quickly. Do you know who Chuck Lorre is? Chuck Lorre? Ever heard of Chuck Lorre? He created Two and a Half Men.
Chuck Lorre. Yeah. I mean, Bill Prady, who did Big Bang Theory. Huge, good friend of mine. And in Two and a Half Men, the head writer on that was Eddie Gordesky, another good friend of mine.
Yeah. Well, the reason I'm asking is because the character of Charlie Harper, aka played by Charlie Sheen, was a man that wrote jingles. And what a lot of people don't know is Chuck used to write jingles, right?
Yes, he did.
Did you ever meet him or work
I've
with
never
him?
Met Chuck Lorre, I don't think, but I as I said, I've known Bill for years, and I've known Eddie Gordesky for 35 years. Eddie used to work in the record store that I worked at in Boston called Zounds.
Okay.
News record story.
So how on earth do you write a jingle? And please go ahead and show us with the piano.
I didn't write a lot of them. I just played on a lot of them.
Okay. Oh,
but,
yeah, sure.
But I mean, you know, I mean, it's the same way I write a thing for Penn and Teller. You get an idea of, you know, well, do you want a dark mood here? Is, you know, is something mysterious happening? And you go... You know,
it's very them. It's very them.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that there's a trick coming up in the new season of Fool Us, and he says, they give me direction like we'd like some like bedtime, you know, bedtimey music. So I came up with like a. You know what I mean? And so, you know, it's, I'm writing for the situation, you know what I mean? Like there's a bit that, there's a bit that's called Shadows where Teller, it's one of his most famous bits where there's the shadow of the rose in the vase, and he's cutting off the flowers. And I actually, I'm embarrassed to say, I can't remember what I wrote for it, but it was a minor thing like that. And he just loved it because it understates the action of the bit, without stepping on it. You know what I mean? But yeah, and I mean, jingles are the same thing, you come up with, I mean, in my day, you would come up with, jingles are different now. There's not even real instruments on TV commercials anymore, except now since the pandemic happened, every single commercial is. In these troubled times, try to stay together. You know what I mean? Everything is like minor piano music, you know. In these challenging times, let's look to each other, you know. And that's, you know, I mean, but that's the way they do it, you know.
Do you think your experience and your love for, I mean, can you educate me what jazz piano is? Because I'm going to be completely stupid and what is jazz piano? Like, what does it mean? Like,
we can break it down. This is quickly as to what jazz is.
Yeah, go for it.
Because I just had to teach all this to a Magic Dragon on his video. I don't know if you know Piff the Magic Dragon.
Yeah, I do. Is he in Vegas as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's got a show at the Flamingo. He's hugely successful.
He's done so well, hasn't he?
And he's a wonderful, dear, dear friend. So anyway, so I said we're going to do a series for YouTube called Jazz for Dragons. So let's take a song like a song called "Swonderful" by George and Ira Gershwin. That's the song. Mm-hmm. It has chords, and songs have melody and harmony. The melody is.
Yeah.
The harmony is. What jazz musicians do is take that harmony and write a whole new melody over it. And that's what jazz improvising is. So you take a song like "Swonderful," you play a little bit of the melody with little things thrown in, like. And then you play the melody that way, and then you play a whole new melody based on those chords. Over the, so you're going. And that's what jazz is.
Okay. So is
so
it
now?
Yeah, go carry on. No, tell me, you're educating me. I'm just trying to learn. I love jazz, but again, don't really know how it works.
Well, that's what you're listening for is when you're listening to Miles Davis or John Coltrane or anything, they're playing a song. And then they're improvising new melodies on those chord changes. Right. So when you play like All Blues from Kind of Blue, they play the melody, and then he's going. You know what I mean? They're just making up new melodies now. But in jazz piano, that's all a given. But jazz piano started around the 1920s as different styles began appearing. And so first was like stride piano, which was a very, like, it sounds very old timey now, like, you know, That was the style where they were trying to play the bass line and play the chords at the same time. And that grew out of ragtime. And then as bass players began working in the 1930s and the ideas of these small groups came up, you didn't have to do this much stuff with your left hand because the bass player was playing the bass notes. So people like Teddy Wilson and famous jazz pianists from the 1930s would play they'd play a chord in their left hand or maybe a tenth. And the bass player would play. So anyways, then you went in, then you get into bebop, which is different harmonic ideas based on like, so if you're playing a song like "Swonderful," instead of using the notes from the original to make your melody for improvising, instead of using the notes from the original harmony, you're using extended versions. So like, an E flat, major 7, 9, 11, sharp 9. You start using those. This is really getting complicated, but you start using those harmonic notes for your melodies. So instead of, so basically a non-bebop version of Swonderful would be a more swing version where you go. And then a bebop version would be like. You're just using upper structure triads, it's called, from, and that's what bebop was. And so Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and all the people that invented that. Anyway, so that's enough, like, overall history of jazz. But I try to play this style that was invented by my hero, a guy named Dave McKenna. I studied Oscar Peterson stuff, and Oscar was, like, the next iteration of Art Tatum, the greatest jazz piano player in history. And he's playing all the great harmonic ideas and all the great, and with this incredible pianism that's like reminiscent of Chopin or Liszt. And but when I was at Berkeley, I heard Dave McKenna, and Dave McKenna played a different style that he developed himself, which is to play a bass line and the chords and solo all at the same time. So it sounds, they used to call him a three-handed piano player. And I just thought it was the greatest thing I ever heard in my life and wanted to learn how to do it. So I locked myself in a practice room for 6 hours every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, and 8 hours every Monday and Wednesday and Friday. And about 30 years later, I started to get a handle on how to do it. But so, for example, I'll actually play this song all the way through. But I'll give you a quick example. So here's a song called Sunny Side of the Street, On the Sunny Side of the Street. And the chords are. And that would be how a piano player working with a bass player would play it. I mean, a little bit better, he'd probably play it. And the bass player would be playing. But what Dave McKenna did was he would play, so he's playing the bass part, the chords, and soloing at the same time.
Wow.
So I thought everybody that I was going to Berkeley with at the time was playing all their, Chicken Herbie stuff and their Keith Jarrett stuff, and I wanted to play Oscar Peterson and Dave McKenna stuff because I just think that that's too cool to let fall by the wayside. You know what I mean? I wanted somebody to keep that idea going for the next 40 years, you know, back in the 1980s. So that's what I do, you know.
That's beautiful.
Unusual and different. And I mean obviously I can work with a bass player. I work with Penn every night, and I just don't get in his way with that stuff. But left to my own devices, you know, I did 6 solo albums for Chiaroscuro, and then for Capri, I'm doing trio records because he says solo records don't sell. But, I mean, that's what I do that's different from every other piano player. I mean, a lot of piano players, if asked to play a solo thing, will sit down and play. Which is amazing and wonderful, I mean, for them. But I want to play. You know, I want to play the piano. Okay. So that's what I do.
I'm gonna put you on the spot. Believe it or not, there is a fondness for coffee house jazz. Are you familiar with that? What that means? Any idea at all?
Only that I've heard some jazz playing in Starbucks now and then.
That's what I'm talking about. There is a community of people and people can doubt me all they want, community people who adore it, and there's Spotify playlists for it, like Coffee House Jazz. So
wow.
If I was to put you on the spot, would you be able to kind of come up with an idea for a theme for like how it would play? I mean, it's obvious you could just play slow jazz, I guess, but you know, that sort of, like, I'll paint the scene for you. It's a wet afternoon, okay, it's a bit windy, it's cold, you've just gone into your favorite coffee house. It doesn't have to be a Starbucks, other coffee houses are available, and you've gone in, you're a little bit stressed out, you've ordered your favorite latte or macchiato, whatever you're going to order, and you're sitting there, and you know, you're dripping wet, you've taken your coat off, you're sitting there, and the music is playing, you're in those comfy little settees, and just you hear that music playing. What sort of, what comes to you, if you can, sort of, if you can? That's already put you on the spot.
Sure. Here you go.
Beautiful. So just to be clear, that's something you've just come up with, right? You've not.
So
how did you compose that then? So what is the how did you
well, you said rainy so I knew we needed minor to start.
Okay.
And I just made up a shitty little melody to go with it.
so it's the melody, and just talk me through the construction.
Well, I mean, thinking of the kind of stuff that you hear in a place like that, you know, and you want it sort of, you know, surfacey, not really, you know, you're not gonna sit in there and play. You know what I mean? You're not gonna, you want sparse. You know, and that's, you know. Gee, I should make a Starbucks album.
I think you should. Yeah. You can give me a commission for the idea.
Sure, absolutely.
Mike, I've got to ask you now a serious question. There's a lot of people out there who are so passionate about music, and they're traditionists like you. They're working on proper pianos, proper instruments, and so on and so forth. And, you know, okay, they're not necessarily going to work with Penn and Teller, but they'd love to be But they want to be.
Job.
They want to be doing what you do. They want to be professional musicians.
Uh-huh.
Is there any advice you would give them?
I can say this without sounding like, I think I can say this without sounding like an idiot. And I'm certainly not exaggerating. I've never thought about making a living as a musician because I just didn't know how to do anything else. Mm. So it was never an option for me to say, well, you know, maybe I'll go to law school. It never occurred to me. I mean, I have not been, I mean, I would say by any measure that I'm considered immensely successful. I'm playing in a big show in Vegas every night. I've got a lot of records out. I get to play some gigs when we have time off. But I mean, nobody knows who I am, really. You know what I mean? There's some jazz people that do a little bit. But I haven't had the career that I thought I was going to have, which was headlining the Montreux Jazz Festival and all that stuff. But I made that decision 20 years ago when I took the job with Penn and Teller that I think that my mother would always, she passed away right before I took the job with Penn and Teller, but she would have been so happy that I had a steady income. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's a really hard life. I mean, I've been incredibly lucky. I mean, you know, there are, you know, I mean, I don't deny that I'm very proficient at what I do. But you know, as you said, there's other people sitting at home wanting to be a musician. I mean, the only thing I can say, and it sounds trite, but it's just play every chance you get, go every place you can to take opportunity. I mean, I said it to Penn once. He always gives me shit all the time about this. But I said one time, I said, you know, one of the things I'm proud of with myself is that I've never turned down an opportunity. You know what I mean? So I don't really have like, oh man, if I would have went with, Sheryl Crow and been her keyboard player, you know what I mean? Or something like that. I've never turned down an opportunity to that I regret. And so he immediately started, Mike Jones, A Life Perfectly Lived. You know, he always gives me shit about that, you know? But I mean, it's certainly not perfect, but I mean, I never have said, I mean, when Penn said to me, do you want to play in our magic show? You know, anybody I don't want to say anyone would have jumped at it, but I certainly thought twice about it. I thought, well, I don't know, do I, you know? Because I knew it would limit the chance that I would get. I mean, I had been doing these floating jazz festival cruises for years and, you know, in meeting and playing with Jerry Mulligan and Clark Terry and Flip Phillips and, you know, all these famous musicians. And I knew that if I took this gig, I wouldn't be able to do those things anymore. But then I said, you know, I want to be associated with these guys. I think what they're doing is really art, you know, and not a schlocky show, you know? And so yeah, I mean, I don't know. My advice is to play as much as you can play, you know, and hopefully the money will sort of take care of itself, you know?
And practice, Mike. Surely you got to, these people have got to practice.
I've been playing the piano for 55 years almost, you know? So I forget some of the things that I was doing 35 years ago when I was at Berkeley. But you have to practice. You have to get to a level on your instrument that you're doing what you want, you know? You can't have hesitation. You have to have the technical expertise. You have to put the hours in to have a language on the instrument, whether you're playing trumpet, piano, guitar. You can't be hobbled by a lack of vocabulary. You know, I mean, I know how to play like Keith Jarrett and Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock and Oscar Peterson and Bill Evans and Teddy Wilson and Fats Waller and Art Tatum. And I can do a decent impersonation of all of them. And if I couldn't do that, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing what I do. You know what I mean? Trying to pretend that I have a language of my own, because you have to study the greats to develop a language that you can speak. Mm. So.
And don't you think some musicians put a lot of pressure on themselves?
I think there's a huge amount of pressure on every musician. I mean, I still have moments of, I mean, less so now that I've been with Penn and Teller for so long, but among I play a solo piano concert in front of a jazz audience, and I'm very aware that I have to be good, you know? And, you know, up until I was in my early 30s, I can tell you one more story. I don't know how much time we've gone over or we have left at this point.
Go for it.
So I was playing on the Floating Jazz Festival in 1999. I hadn't seen Oscar Peterson probably in 10 or 12 years. And I was playing on this jazz festival and he was on it. It was on the QE2. And so I went down. Now, these names will mean nothing to you, but trust me when I tell you, these are the biggest people in jazz piano history, basically. So I go to sit down at the piano the first night that I'm playing, and I look to my right to the right of my, where the keyboard ends, and there's Oscar Peterson sitting there. And next to Oscar Peterson is Monty Alexander, and next to Monty Alexander is Tommy Flanagan, and next to Tommy Flanagan is Shirley Horn, and next to Shirley Horn is Kenny Drew Jr., and next to Kenny Drew Jr. is Bill Charlap, and next to Bill Charlap is Teddy Rosenthal. And every pianist on the ship was there to watch me play. And I was literally scared to death, right? Every hero of mine and everybody that's anybody in the world of jazz piano is sitting there. So I sat down at the piano and I looked over into all of their faces and I said, oh, no, no, no. and I got up and walked away from the piano, and everybody started laughing. And so then anyways, I sat down and I played an hour. And as I was leaving the piano stool, Oscar, who was in his, he was in a golf cart type thing, you know, one of his, one of those guys for his arthritis. He pulled me down and said in my ear, "You're taking no prisoners tonight, Mike." Mm-hmm. And immediately this huge weight, you know, lifted off my shoulders because I didn't make a fool of myself. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And, no, I get it. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, honestly, you know, then the next day I'm walking down the hallway and Marty Alexander steps out of his room and he starts motioning for me to come near him. Sorry. And of course I was shaking. I was like, oh my God, he's going to tell me I suck. What am I doing playing the piano? Give it up. Right. And he takes me into his room and he said, he has a Jamaican accent. And he says, "Mike, you've got to stop this self-deprecating shit, man. You're too good. There's only like two or three of us in the world and you're one of us." And I was like, oh, you know, I said, "Monty, I bought your Montreux Alexander record when I was 15. I wore through two copies of the vinyl album. And it was the first CD I bought when CDs were invented. Allow me to be a little self-deprecating in your presence." And he said, no, you can't do that, man. You're too good. And it was, so since then, I've at least had this like knowledge deep inside me that I'm pretty good at what I do. But I'll be the first to admit that I can get a hell of a lot better. And I hope that I'm a lot better in 20 years than I am now. I'm certainly a lot better now than I was 20 years ago when I first went with Penn and Teller, you know. And that's the other thing for every musician. And I think any musician that's serious knows this. You've got to keep growing, you know. Otherwise, why are you doing it? Why are you playing the same songs the same way? What's the fun in that?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, you might have actually answered my final question to you. And it's been nothing short of an absolute pleasure having you on and talking to you.
Well, you never shut up. I mean, I couldn't even
to make a long story even longer.
Exactly.
but I've got to ask you this, and you might be repeating yourself, but ask everybody, almost everybody, have you got any other final pearls of wisdom that you like to share with the listeners that have made it through to the end of the show, just so they can, you know,
all three of them. they'll have given up by now. I've listened to them. I would say, yes, if you're this is strictly musicians' advice, but I think it could probably be moved into many other things. Never forget what your job is. And that's, you know what I mean? I get asked to write music for Penn and Teller, and I'm saying this because this is a pearl of wisdom, because I was explaining this to someone yesterday. I did some music for Penn and Teller for one of their tricks for their new season, and the producer called me up, and the director called me up, Dennis, and he's a wonderful guy, and he wanted to do what he thought was the right thing by saying to me, "Well, you know, we've cut up your music a little bit, and I want to play it for you and make sure you're all right with it." And I said, "Are you all right with it?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Is Teller all right with it?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "I don't need to hear it." I said, "I did my job. You know, my job was to give you something that you could use. How you use it is your artistic, you know, vision." And so I am not, I think, don't take yourself too seriously. Understand that what you do has value. And I mean, and this is in everything in life. Every person has value, and everything is important, but it's always much more important to the individual than it is to society. I used to have to yell at my dad, who was in his 80s and still working as he sold greeting cards to, you know, he took orders for greeting cards at retail stores. And he would subject these poor people that just wanted to buy next year's calendar from Kamar to, you know, a half hour lecture on Mike Jones with samples by playing in my tapes and CDs and stuff. And I had to say to my dad, 90% of the world doesn't care about jazz. And of the 10% that does, 1% might care about jazz piano. And of the 1% that does, 1/100th of that cares about the weird arcane style of solo jazz piano that I play. You don't have to do this, you know, but of course he was just proud of his son, you know, but, sure. But I mean, I don't take myself too seriously because I know I'm not curing Ebola or Corona or AIDS or, you know, cancer. I'm playing music, which is at the root of it is entertainment. Yeah. I mean, Penn and Teller always say there's one show business, whether you're a birthday party clown or you're on stage at Carnegie Hall. And there is a truth. There is a lot of truth in that statement. It's all show business. But, you know, the people that get to Carnegie Hall are a little more serious about it than the people that are playing birthday parties, you know? So that's my advice is don't get too serious about your job. Understand what your job is and do it to the best of your ability. I mean, when I'm playing Coffee House Jazz for you, you know, I'm making light of it, but I'm not going to play something inappropriate. I'm going to play what you asked for, you know?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
It'll be
on
my next record.
Maybe you can play us off. Can you play us off just a little bit?
Sure.
Play us
off. Sure.
Hey, podcaster, you made it right to the end of the show. That's quite commendable. Well done. What did you think? Did you like it? Did you hate it? All feedback is much appreciated by me, so please get in touch with me, even if you fancy being a guest on my show. Head over to scgshow.com or contact me through my YouTube channel, as I respond to almost everybody who gets in touch. Have a great day. Stay safe. Keep podcasting.